Fink. Did you hear that?
Of course I did.
Sorry. Alas. Last week, we ended in verses 16 and 17 of chapter 8, where we saw the need and necessity of the saints for trusting the sovereign hand of God. And when I applied my heart to know wisdom and to see the business that is done on the earth, how neither day nor night do one's eyes see sleep, then I saw all the work of God, that man cannot find out the work that is done under the sun. However much man may toil in seeking, he will not find it out. Even though a wise man claims to know, he cannot find it out. This, again, does not mean that man cannot learn things, nor that man can discern things. Of course he can. We know that. But is it possible, is it even remotely possible for us to know and understand all things? And we can't. We can't. A blessing that we can know and understand the cosmos and the circuits of the planets, and that's helpful to us. But sometimes the whys and wherefores of events we cannot know, and we will never know on this side of paradise. We will likely never know all the reasons that God may have for doing anything that he does. We may get snippets. We may see some application in our own life and never fully know. We read in Isaiah, "Your thoughts are not my thoughts." This is God speaking. "Neither are your ways my ways, declares the Lord. For as high as the heavens are from the earth, so are my ways from your ways. And as far as the east is from the west, so is my thought from your thought." Shouldn't lead us to despair. Okay? For the one who doesn't know the Lord, or the one who does not know the Lord well, who holds to the Lord weakly, it can lead to despair. Another thing that we discussed last week is that it can lead to fatalism. What is fatalism?
Doesn't matter what I do.
Yep. Who cares? Might as well drive without your seatbelt. Okay. No, those things are not good. It should spur us to really worship the living God. Again, chapter breaks, verse breaks, and little subheads in the Bible are oftentimes awkward and break up what is a continuous train of thought here. And I see this at this point. So if we take that and move into the start of verse 9, "But all this I laid to heart, examining it all, how the righteous and the wise and their deeds are in the hand of God." The righteous man and his deeds are in God's sovereign hand. How far are we willing to go with that? How far are we willing to go with God's sovereignty within the righteous man and his deeds? Does Scripture paint... Okay, one says all the way and one says not very far. Well...
Are you on chapter 9, verse 1?
I am. Chapter 9, verse 1. "All this I laid to heart, examining it all, how the righteous and the wise and their deeds are in the hand of God." Okay, is that true?
True.
True. It's true. I will declare it to be true. Why? Because it says it in Scripture. Does it say it in more places than this? Do we get the implication that God is sovereign over the deeds and affairs of men? Yeah. Throughout Scripture. Does this mean you have no choice?
No. Well, you can choose to be a righteous man.
Well, if God is sovereign over my deeds, do I still have choice?
Yes.
And you know, I'm gonna go with the obvious. You know, I can touch the days, I cannot touch the days. I can touch the days, I cannot touch the days. You know, I can do that. I can raise my left foot, I cannot raise my left foot. I am choosing, am I not?
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So we know that we are volitional creatures. We know that. Does that negate God's sovereignty?
No.
No. Does Scripture make both of these truths plain? Yes. Okay. Let's kind of go back to the last part of chapter 8. Even though a wise man claims to know, he cannot find it out. So are you going to get it? Are you gonna comprehend that God is sovereign and I still have choice?
No.
No, I'm not. So, I mean, can I think on it? Yeah. Is it gonna turn you into a pretzel? Probably. A philosophical knot? Yes.
Unless you agree.
And so I worship, but I would contend even God is sovereign in my choices.
Yeah, which that's where you can get fatalism, because it doesn't really matter what I do, because God already knows what my choice is.
God ordained them.
Yeah.
I was listening to Tony Evans on the radio driving back. This week, and he was talking about Haman and Esther. Did you hear that?
I believe so.
And he was talking about how within Esther, I mean, God's name is not mentioned at all within Esther, a very unique aspect of the book, but within that, you see everything going to the crescendo, the climax of the story, and you see God ordaining events. That Esther would put off the meal to give Haman time to increase in his anger and his fury toward Mordecai. To Mordecai being exalted even higher before the king, where Haman has to drag him around the city, you know, and exalting Mordecai. And Haman's fury getting so great that he builds a gallows for Mordecai. He had built a gallows for Mordecai. And then, you know, when all of this is exposed and Haman is the traitorous cur that he is, Xerxes leaves the room to walk out in the garden to kind of cool off. And he comes in and Haman's arguing with his wife and has actually fallen upon her. And so Xerxes just goes through the roof. The attendant goes, oh, by the way, Haman has built a gallows. And Xerxes says, hang him on it. And all of these events ordained by God based on decisions that Haman chose to make to ultimately put him on his own gallows. Is this good fodder for evangelism? Sovereignty of God and the free will of man. Good. No. No. Dude, if I can't get my arms around it, then these are things I'm not going to sprinkle into evangelism. It's only going to really promote argument. And not the reflection that it should for the saint. For the saint, it should spur and prompt and promote reflection and worship for us. So Solomon lays all this to heart and he sees essentially that God is sovereign in this. Whether it is love or hate, continuing in verse 1, man does not know. Both are before him. What, you know, are we going to have situations where love comes to us, or is it going to be hate? We don't know, under the sun. But will we still abide in the peace of God? And so as Solomon is pondering God's sovereign hand, God's magnitude and majesty, the smallness of man is made very apparent within contrast. And we see the finitude, or the finiteness of man under the sun. In verse 2, it is the same for all, since the same event happens to the righteous and the wicked, to the good and the evil. Now he speaks of this event, the same event. He's going to do that a couple of times, and ultimately then he will expose what that same event is. And it doesn't take a rocket scientist to know what is the same event that happens to everyone. Death. Death. Death happens to everyone. Death. Many of us know, you can evade taxes. I know one who does, at least income taxes. Sales tax is pretty hard to evade. But income tax, you know, if you're self-employed, you can dodge that bullet for a while, maybe. Maybe for a long time. But death is a specter, a phantom that hangs over man. Death is a specter that hangs over man. The same event happens to all. Notice, now he goes here in verse 2, and he looks at various categories. The same event happens to the righteous and the wicked, to the good and the evil, to the clean and the unclean, to him who sacrifices and him who does not sacrifice. Really, just two categories. Just two categories. The religious man, the one who is striving after God, the one who is striving to follow and honor God, and the one who does not. Okay, the one who does not. And the same event is going to happen to all men. And we go, yep. We understand that under the sun. He continues in the middle of verse 2, as the good one is, so is the sinner. And he who swears is as he who shuns an oath. Doesn't matter whether you're a sinner or a saint. Doesn't matter where you make vows or not. You're going to die. And Solomon starts in verse 3, says, this is an evil in all that is done under the sun, that the same event happens to all.
Why did he call it evil?
Good. This is an evil. Now, in some ways, with the fact that death has come, well, why is there death, first of all? Sin. There is death because of sin. Okay, so there is death because of sin. Who brought Why is there, again, okay, so there's death because of sin, but why? Okay, but why is there death?
Because that, in a way, is God's mercy.
It's God's judgment.
Well,
there's mercy to it, but it can't. Death comes because of God. Because God laid out a consequence. Here's the tree. Eat from this tree, and you shall surely die. He laid out this consequence. God set this up. So if death, okay, yes, we ate, but God was the one who brought this. Is Solomon in a way indicting God of evil?
No.
Good. Good. We would go, well, certainly not. But can you see where that might be read by some where you go, well, he's kind of indicting God of evil. No. What is the evil? The evil is not that death comes, but that the same event happens to all men. Again, it is an under the sun event. Okay? That is the thing that is evil. It is this perspective under the sun that here you've got people who are righteous trying to live to honor the Lord in all their ways, and they die just like the sinful man.
It kind of seems like it goes towards our what we as people perceive as justice.
Yes. That is important to understand. Everybody has this innate sense of justice. Where does that come from? Where does that come from if we are merely survival of the fittest? It is innate within us. It is woven into us by the God who created us. This desire for justice. And so Solomon, again, you know, I've got in my Bible, every time it says under the sun, it's demarked so I can see it. And his perspective is down here. Okay, on this plane, we see oftentimes this injustice play out. So it is an evil that he is seeing. But it appears that there is no benefit, appears on this plane that there is no benefit for living rightly. And we know that's not true. And again, he references that point often as he gets his eyes up above the clouds, up above the sun from time to time. He continues in verse 3 that all the hearts of the children of man are full of evil, and madness is in their hearts while they live, and after that they go to the dead. Okay, he alluded to that as well back in the previous chapter, that there is none righteous, no, not one. One good man in 1,000, no woman could he find. Again, I'm just kicking there. So, what then? He continues on again in life under the sun. But he who is joined to the living has hope, for a living dog is better than a dead lion. Is it better to be living than dead?
Absolutely.
Not.
No.
Thank you.
Paul says differently.
Paul says no.
Yeah, present with the Lord, obviously.
Yes.
Absolutely. I mentioned this here
but in
recently.
This plane,
exactly. The people who live on this plane, well, you know, somebody will say, hey, how are you doing today? I say, well, I'm vertical. And they'll say, better than the alternative. And I will say, no. And they'll look at me like I have three heads. You know, no. Okay? Do we really believe that? You know, I hope we do. I hope as saints we do. That we will, man, if we're going, no, I really can't get into Paul's, to live as Christ, to die as gain. Better to go and be with the Lord. I have no doubt that there are true believers who struggle with that. And we'll say, no, I can't go there.
Believers who don't want to die. They want
to
live forever. That's a given.
Well, I mean, does anybody here really want to go through that? I mean, what? Ooh, yeah. I'm looking forward to that. Maybe I'll get hit by a truck.
Right.
Great.
I think that for me, I think it's more the fear of, like, how does death come? You know what I mean? Like, am I going to die like as an angel woman peacefully in my
yeah.
day? I mean,
can I forego that?
You know, am I going to die slowly of cancer over 3 years? Like, I think it's the process that's more terrifying than the actual.
We're all waiting. We all want rapture practice.
Yeah.
You know, take me. Take me now, Lord. Take me. Because we don't want to go through that. There. And so, but, okay, let's get our eyes down under the sun for a time. And we see, would you agree that better is a living dog than a dead lion?
I would.
Yeah. Now contrast those two beasts.
One's man's best friend, the other one's man's worst enemy.
In America, that's true. In the Middle East, dogs are not, dogs are like rats.
They're tasty cuisine.
Well, that would be the Far East.
Okay.
That would be the Far East. But dogs are really scavengers. They roam the streets. Not many will have them for pets. But so better to be this thing that's alive than to be the king of the beast and be dead.
Which is weird because you think that you see that a lot of people, you know, that are scavengers or down on their luck would think the opposite of that. Would sometimes be like
you get to the point of despair, but. You know, I would contend that most of the men and women around the faith mission are happy.
Yeah.
You know, they would perhaps change their lot if they could. I mean, they'd love to hit the lottery and have money swimming all over them. But, you know, to be willing to work to that end, I'm happy to be, many, many, many are happy to be a hobo. Okay? Where I have no responsibility to anybody. I'm happy. So, for a living dog is better than a dead lion. He who is joined to the living has hope. For the living know that they will die, but the dead know nothing. So, I'm going to stop because he goes into a fairly long diatribe about where the dead are. The living have hope.
Right. And I think he's referring to the believer. They're the living.
What is the hope for the one who is alive? Okay, you didn't die. You're still alive.
Keep going.
Well, that you'll see them again. I mean, that's your hope is that they are in heaven. Christ, and at some point you will join them. It's not a goodbye forever.
Yeah. So, what is? Go ahead.
I would say, with the context of just being under the sun, if you're living, you still have hope that you can keep doing things. And whether you're a believer or a non-believer, doing things brings you enjoyment, brings you self-worth. All that stuff, whether you're a believer or not.
Okay. So, man, really, this is the end for the unbeliever. And so this is their heaven right now. But if the specter of death is looming over a living man, what is our hope for him?
Salvation.
Yes, that he will consider this sword, this guillotine that is always over him. When is he going to die? You know, the brain aneurysm fires in my head and I collapse on the floor right here, right now. It can happen. You know, isn't that weird? Isn't that weird? Who knows? Who
the
knows?
Blood clot. The blood clot lodges in this.
The widow.
Vein,
yeah, the widow maker. Yep.
Your heart. Poof. You're
done. You don't know. I saw a guy at work on Friday. Am I going to see him Monday? That has happened at my work, where it's a bunch of old guys, where we've lost a man in the middle of the night.
It also happens to the young.
Yes. Oh, you're careful driving, but what about the guy next to you? You know, I was thinking about this last night, going to get Kara. And somebody comes flying over an on-ramp, goes through the median, and hits me head-on. Will I have time? You know, I am always looking for an out. I drive thinking everyone's trying to kill me. I drive paranoid. It's like a dog fight. I drive like I'm in a dog fight, waiting for the bandit to come out and schwack me. But you know what? That keeps you ready so that you're not complacent in times like that. But you don't know. Yeah, ride motorcycles, same thing, man. You have to be. So I would contend this is a good thing. This specter of death that hangs over men is a good thing, hopefully to force them to consider. There is still hope for the living. You know, once somebody dies, there's no hope for their salvation. It is done. It is appointed to man to die once, and then the judgment. So while he is alive, there's hope. And what should that drive us to? As believers, what should that drive us to?
Sharing.
Yes, starts with an E, evangelism. You know, it should be sharing the hope of the gospel, sharing the hope that is within us, that this is not all there is, that there is hope. You know, at the same time, I would contend that, you know, a lot of people say, oh, you know, don't scare them into heaven, you know, with the consequence of hell and all that. Well, why would I want to be saved if I didn't realize I had to be saved? A drowning man, dude, he'll grab on anything when he realizes he's about to die.
Even the person he's trying to save.
Yeah, but if I'm just sitting lolling in my pool and somebody's throwing me a life preserver, I'm going to be going, what? I don't need that. And so, man, to try and expose somebody to the fact that we live treasonous against God. I mean, we are the rebel scum. That should be annihilated. We're vermin as we shake our puny little fists at God. So it really should spur us toward a heart of evangelism. And he goes on here to essentially describe the state and the status of the dead. A dead man knows nothing. Okay, is that true?
Truly.
Well,
he knows the judgment.
And knows the, now you know the glory of God. I mean, I would contest that you know more than you did on this plane.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. But again, from this perspective, he's dead and in the ground. He doesn't know what's going on. He's not here in our study because he is.
I mean, you also have that mindset of like when people talk about judgment, saying like somebody's looking down on you from heaven. No, they're not. They have no idea what you're doing. I hate to tell you, like, you are not worried about the people you left behind when you are standing before the creator of the universe. Like, so you don't know what's going on here. That's true. Like,
I won't get into it. I think there's a verse that hints to the opposite.
Really?
I do. But I just heard.
I didn't tell me. I just had this conversation with somebody. Like,
John MacArthur would absolutely agree with you. He goes,
that's why, you know, I listen to a lot of conversations.
When you are in the presence of the Holy God, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses.
There you go. When were you avengers?
Witnesses, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, tells us to keep running the race, to look unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, almost like they're cheering us on there. And that's Hebrews chapter 12, verse 1. Does that mean they're looking down? MacArthur would say no. He even looked at that verse in particular. But in some ways, you go, that is really cool. That, you know, the saints in heaven are still, you know, they're not praying for us. You know, this isn't a Marian Catholic thing, but to go, they're seeing, if they now have a comprehension of Christ's work having unfolded in their life, could they not feasibly see Christ's work continuing to unfold here on the earth? And they're looking to the Savior going, you know, what's going to happen? You know, in an excited sort of way.
Yeah.
What's going on? I don't know. But it's one of... That is not something I have a firm conviction over because, I don't know. Interesting point though. Okay, so the dead know nothing. They have no more reward.
Right.
Absolutely.
They have no more reward.
Absolutely, especially those apart from Christ, man. They've got everything. All the good stuff was right here. For the saint, we are going to have... this is nasty. Not nasty. But this will pale in comparison. It's like a child's toy to an adult. You go, dude, I really don't want to play Candyland. And they're going, oh, let's play Candyland. You go, no. Heaven is going to be so much beyond Candyland. No more reward. The memory of them is forgotten. At 54 years old, this one kind of whacks me upside the head more and more. Is that, you know, nobody remembers my dad. Except me and my brother. And my kids, to some extent, maybe a few of his friends. But when his friends all die, and none of my kids know my dad's dad. Yeah. So when I die and my brother dies, that man will be forgotten unless he is simply a name on my genealogy. You know, there are very few Abraham Lincolns in the world whose name goes on, who have monuments erected to them. So the memory... Yeah, I paid money. Not,
but still, it's just the name.
But you don't, yeah,
it is.
Don't know,
but yeah, that's the thing.
Like, you have no idea.
Think of all the people that have been enormous contributors to our society. Who invented the battery? It goes by the name of Bolt.
You know, here's this should make our hearts sing and rejoice. The memory of them is soon forgotten. There is one. There is one who remembers everyone. And that's the living God.
I think that's why it's so important that Ty and I talk about this often, to say, you know, it's not things that we want to leave to our children to say, oh, I got this from my dad that nobody remembers. It's like, you know, we were the first... really the first believers in our family. And so now we are starting this, hopefully, you know, a legacy of met a lot of men who follow the Lord and who will raise up their children to follow the Lord. And that's, you know, that's what, you know, you might not remember me, but you will carry
the
this on. Yes.
And he will know. He knows what you did. He knows what you did, and he knows better what you did than you know. Because he knows all of the consequences of what you did. Of all of the gold, rubies, and precious stones that you built with. And he will show them to you and reward you for them in the life to come. You will see all of the ripples because he will make them known. Because of you, this. I go, oh, I never realized. You know, and I was sitting home bawling my eyes out because I felt like such a failure. You know, what a joy. What a joy for the person in despair that God knows. Turn to him and live. Turn to him and live. The memory of the dead is soon forgotten. Their love, their hate, their envy, whatever emotion they have, it's perished. You can love no more. You can hate no more. Forever, they have no more share in all that is done under the sun. You're done. Your investments... You know, I mentioned this before, too, when I was going through pilot training. The guy who was the head over our class, he was a Caustic former fighter pilot. And he would say, you know, if you die, somebody else is going to drive your car, going to play your stereo, and marry your wife.
That's why he was caustic.
Well, no, that was probably one of the nicer things he said. But you're not, you can't take it with you. It's all done. It's finished. So the dead are done under the sun. They've had their joy. And so we go, oh man, this is like drag. You know, Ecclesiastes a lot of times can just really bring you down if you are seeing it here. But if we keep our eyes up, we go, what a great perspective this is. And then he goes on again with a great look up above the clouds. So we see a breath of fresh air. And he calls us to enjoy. We've heard it again before. He emphasizes it again. Enjoy. Go. Eat your bread with joy. Drink your wine with a merry heart. For God has already approved what you do. So, you know, again, we are to enjoy. But the second half of that verse makes us go.
Approve what you do.
Wait. Go. So go enjoy because God's already approved what you do. And you go, you know, if you're just plowing through reading, you know, trying to get your three chapters in a day, and all of a sudden you go, whoa, and you stop, and then go, what? What sort of things have taken place in history that God did not approve?
None.
Good, excellent. So, what does the word approve mean?
Yes, I would say that God does not approve of the actions of Adolf Hitler and the entire Holocaust. However, he allowed it to happen. So, there's an
approval.
With regards to that, I mean, okay. he doesn't approve of drunkenness,
right? Sin. I mean, in general,
sexual immorality. Okay. All that kind of stuff.
So let's talk about the word approve. To approve something means I either declare something to be good. Okay? That's one way the word approve is used. Another what's another way we could use the word approve?
Accept.
Yeah, kind of flesh that out.
By me.
Yes. I can either confirm a thing to be good or I can confirm a thing to be done. You know, somebody comes to me and says, hey, I'd like to build this, and I'm the city contractor and I approve that. Okay, I okay it. I permit it. I believe the King James doesn't use approve, it uses accept it. Okay. But the sense of the word is this.
Yeah.
In the Hebrew, it's I approve. You know, this is a good thing. Now, Solomon tells us to enjoy, to eat, drink, essentially eat, drink, and be merry. For God has already approved of what you do.
But is he talking to believers? Because it's like what Pastor Tomlin said years ago. He said, you know, love God and do whatever you want. So that, is he speaking to believers or in general?
I really think we can take this in both senses. You know, for the believer, and this is so important. This is so important. If I am living a passionate love relationship with Christ, what can I do?
What can you do then?
Whatever I want, because those things my desires are going to be lined up with Christ's.
And even Pharaoh and Haman, they were passionate about getting rid of God's people.
Yeah, but they were not in a passionate love relationship with the living God.
But they were working God's plan.
And God accepted what they did. God approved. Nothing can happen without God's approval. His permission, his ordination. And I would go so far as to say ordination, that he even puts it in the hearts of men to do evil.
Yes, he does. Says so in Isaiah. God created good and evil.
God did not create evil. God did not create evil. God created the possibility for evil.
By giving us free choice. I mean, that's, yeah.
You know, and that started with Satan. As Satan, a volitional being, rebelled against the living God. God is not the author of evil. But he will order it for ultimate good and for his glory. So, as a believer, we rejoice in God's sovereign hand on our life. We seek his face, his glory, and his pleasure. And we know that whether love or hatred come to us, that God has a perfect plan. And so God really approved in both senses for the believer. All that befalls us and all that comes our way. And therefore, we enjoy. And he gives us some descriptors of how we enjoy life. Let your garments always be white. You know? Okay, what's that mean?
Me, it's metaphorically. Let your garments be clean.
Why? Okay, is the garment idea a metaphor, or is he encouraging us to have clean clothes?
Both are encouraging.
For having to be righteous.
There's a level of acceptability when it comes to soiled garments.
You know, I actually wrote that down here. You know, in a sense, there is a truth to that.
Yeah.
Why? I tell my children this. Why do we teach them manners? Why is it important to have manners?
Because people at the table can be a little bit picky that he's unrefined.
Because it shows respect. It's an act of selflessness to say that I am regarding someone else above myself.
Yes.
Because even if someone is picky, you know, we just had this conversation with Keenan just the other day, you know, that you might not care, but if somebody else does, then you are showing them love in putting their, you know, their choice, their preference above your own.
Yes. I have manners for other people. I am not an animal. And so I show love to you by having manners and courtesy. I let you go first. I submit myself to you. Why would I want to be clean? For your sake. Because you don't want to walk by me and go, oh my goodness. Dude. You know, I'm an offense. I'm to be all things to all people. And so to be clean is really a blessing to other people. It is not an off-putting thing. Well, what about oil on my head? Let not oil be lacking on your head.
Oh, that sounds good.
Okay.
I mean, in that sense, that's one of the things that they used. It wasn't like they bathed regularly, so.
That's not being. See, I got a trip from let your garments be white and let not oil be lacking on your head. It's being righteous and being anointed, essentially.
Okay, you're being spiritual, Ty.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I'm thinking culturally and historically,
yes.
They didn't bathe every day. And so you use these oils because it's what made you smell nicer to other people around you. Like
it today grooming.
Yeah. Good personal hygiene.
Grooming. You know,
you're so deep, Ty.
I'm clean. I'm clean, and I present myself neatly.
It is a good, you do think about it, though, that, like, it is a good metaphor for being righteous and holy, you know?
Yes.
They still sell it. I think the jar is yellow. It looks like a little crown with a spike on it. Riotane.
Well, see, I took that along with seven, the verse of seven, you know, because that's a very fine line with eat your bread with joy and drink your wine with a merry heart, because it's a very fine line to go from that over into drunkenness, and then with the following line, let your garments be white, let your...
You can become a Pharisee on these things.
Yeah.
But really, it's a question of stewardship. God has given me this body and these things. What things last longer? If I never wash my clothes, or if I keep my clothes clean? If I wear my clothes until they fall apart, or if I darn and mend them? You know, it's a stewardship of what God has given me to include my body. I want to keep my body as well. All aspects of it. For health and well-being. So to enjoy life also means there's going to be labor involved to steward what God has given me. He goes on with regard to enjoyment. Enjoy life with the wife whom you love all the days of your vain life that he's given you under the sun. Because that is your portion in life and in your toil, which you toil under the sun. Okay? So enjoy your marriage. Enjoy your marriage. How many people enjoy their marriage? Enjoy it. Oh, I love my wife. I love to be with my wife. I love to... You know... Tracy and I just went up to Canyon for a night. Just she and I.
Where is that?
Canyon, Texas. Where Austin's going to school. You know, what a joy. Why do we not enjoy our spouses? Why do we not enjoy time with our spouses?
Are you asking metaphorically? Or,
no. Rhetorically.
Rhetorically?
Yeah.
Sorry,
yeah, well, it's one big metaphor today.
Yeah, no metaphor.
Why do we not enjoy our spouses? Okay.
Really, you think it's usually is about because this person is not making me happy. You know, what you're doing is not pleasing to me. Because really, when you hear people complain about their spouse, it's what they did to you. You know, or what
score?
They said to you.
Let me pull out my scorecard.
Yeah,
I think too society doesn't want us to. Right? There are ball and chain. There.
Yeah.
Why would you be happy with one person
or one? For you Netflix or television watchers, can you name a happily married family on television today?
The Wards.
The Wards?
The news from TV today, though.
Yeah. I'm talking a long time
ago. Yeah. I mean, you can go back in the 50s and Ward and June loved each other. Ward and June Cleaver and
Waltons?
Father Knows
Waltons.
Best the Waltons.
Oh,
yeah.
Earlier.
So, you know... We don't, work gets in the way, kids get in the way, and we don't communicate. So how do we enjoy our spouse? You got to enjoy your spouse day by day, every day, to consider the treasure that you have in the spouse. He who finds, it's Proverbs 18:22, one of my favorite verses in Scripture. He who finds a wife finds a good thing and obtains favor from the Lord. Believe it, live it, communicate. Man, we got to communicate. What gets in the way? Do this thing. Gets in the way. Television.
Amen,
television gets in the way. Turn the thing off. Play cards. Go force yourself to look at one another and play cribbage. Learn cribbage. Learn gin. You know, a two-person card game. Play cards together or buy a two-player game. Be affectionate, man. Be affectionate to your spouse. Fewer people are in here married than not, but these are things we can exhort and encourage amongst our friends too. Newly married, long married. Be affectionate, be intimate, play with them. Again, not necessarily intimately, but play with them, work with them. Do things together in the home, work together. Pray for them and your marriage. Pray for married people. Pray for marriages. And the phrase, a lot of reform guys use this phrase, coram Deo. Coram Deo. Before the face of God is what it means. Live before the face of God. Understand that your relationship is always before God, especially as believers there. So enjoy your wife is what it says. Enjoy your spouse. Verse 10, also enjoy your work. Whatever your hand finds to do, do it with your might. For there is no work or thought or knowledge or wisdom in Sheol, in the place of the dead. Okay, again, there is no work in this plane, in this life. I believe there will be work in heaven, as Jeremy mentioned two weeks ago. I believe very firmly there will be work in heaven. It will be good work, refreshing work, and continuing for God's glory. But here on this plane, he tells us to work in what manner? Yeah, work hard. Again, for God's glory. Work hard. At what things should I be laboring hard at?
Everything.
Yes, such as? Yes. Finals week. You know, I can be a skater or I can really invest in my schoolwork, in my studies.
Telling other moms that it's okay if your house is a complete wreck because you have kids and this is a stage and these things. And I think, no, but it's not okay. Like, you know, you should, I get it. My house gets to be a wreck sometimes. But, like, you should still, like, this should be important to you. Like, you should work hard at this too. And I always try to, like, encourage them to say, like, you know, get your, you know, make your kids do some chores because this is important. You know, this is your
industry.
This is your job.
Yes.
Like, yours, you know, even if you're not a stay-at-home mom, I mean, this is part of your job. And so it is important. And what are you modeling to your children that, you know, that you don't have to do these things? And this has been, as my kids have gotten a little bit older, I am the worst about, like, I set something down and then I get distracted and I walk away. And so, and now I'm not picking up after myself. And I'm teaching this to my children.
That's one of the things, too. I think that when it comes to that kind of stuff, because I'm kind of the opposite of her. I'm the one that goes
that's
behind
so
her closing, you know, closing cabinets.
I close
and
cabinets
now I'm seeing it, you know, before it was just Sean and I, so it was
yeah,
now
good
it's
luck with
me
that.
And
yeah,
seven other people that are picking up this habit.
Okay, so but, we work hard in the home.
Yes.
Work hard keeping our home.
And it's important. I mean, you to work hard in all of the things, like even those little things, like that. I mean,
what about in church? Should we work hard in church? What's hard work?
What are you referencing?
In the church?
Work
yeah. What
like
what hard work should there be done in the church?
Just fill in the blank.
Yeah, everything.
I mean, what were we hearing at the start of our class today?
Right.
Yes. You know, what is probably the hardest place to work on Sunday morning?
With my kid.
The nursery.
Yeah.
The nursery. Okay, that is why, you know, we beg and plead with the women to, you know, sign up.
And it is like,
you know, once a month it'd be great. If you go once a month, I'm going to sign up and take the nursery during worship. Again, Sunday school is covered by the month. So Tracy's got it and then Sarah's got it and I think they're rotating. But, you know, apart from that, man, to sign up for one Sunday a month where I'm going to sacrifice and watch the kids, that's great. That's huge.
And it also frees up, to do other work. Like, I need to be fed. You know, if I'm working in the nursery every Sunday, then I am not getting, you know,
now,
I'm not getting fed. And it's...
Because you're a mom, does that mean I don't have to work in the nursery?
No.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, I don't have kids anymore. Tracy goes, I don't have kids anymore. I don't, or kids in the nursery, so I don't have to work in the nursery.
I am a firm... Sarah and I actually had this conversation not that long ago that I'm a firm believer. Like, it's okay. Like, the ladies know, like, I took, like, a whole month off, and I was like, guys, I need a break to, like, have Sundays away from my kids and be just continuously be fed. And they're like, good, do it. And now I'm, you know, signed up for the next month. And it bothers me, like you said, when older women. We went to a church like this at one point. They say, I shouldn't have to be in here anymore. Or when young moms say, like, but I'm with them all the time,
right.
So I shouldn't have
yeah.
to serve.
Now, there comes a point where a woman can't.
Right.
I mean,
right.
you know, I don't want Judy up there, and I don't want Mary up there.
Right. And
unless they want to be. But, man, trying to keep... So, prayer's another aspect of work. Teaching. If I'm just phoning this in, if I'm just whipping through it, shame on me. Any of our Sunday school teachers. I don't care if it's little kids. We need to prepare. Pray and prepare over them. Our deacons laboring to keep our structures proper. So there's tons of work. We'll talk more about this next week and finish chapter 9 next week, because ultimately we get to an unsettling roll of the dice. And life is random chance. I'm out of time. That's it. You're cleared off.